From KCRW, this is Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiotakis with the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Over the weekend in Venice, mourners gathered for a candlelight and flower vigil for a 31-year-old man named Keenan Anderson. Anderson is the father and English teacher whom LAPD officers repeatedly tased after a car crash. He died of cardiac arrest.
How many more hundreds of years must we endure this? God, this young man did all the right thing. He went to college, and then he decided to use his education to give back to our people, to young people. And he's killed in this manner.
Now, the LAPD has this program called SMART. It stands for System-Wide Mental Assessment Response Team. It's designed to send out mental health professionals to help navigate and de-escalate encounters with people suffering certain crises. In all three of those interactions with police, no such team was ever called in. Well, with us to talk about it is Ben Adam Clymer, the creator of Crisis. That's an organization that consults and trains local governments in the area of crisis intervention and trauma-informed care. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
And Paula Miner is a member of Black Lives Matter Los Angeles and team leader of police accountability there. Paula, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Criminal justice reform, Paula, advocates from Black Lives Matter, they held this event this morning with County Supervisor Lindsay Horvath and L.A. City Councilman Marquise Harris-Dawson. They were asking for a different approach to policing, as has been asked in the past for years and years and years. What would you like to see the LAPD do differently?
One of the main things we would like for LAPD, for our city government to do is to prevent or stop LAPD from being involved in situations that they are not trained to handle. Minor traffic stops, instances where people are having a mental challenge or a substance abuse challenge. These are situations where people need help, not harm.
Ben, I got to ask you, you know, you train teams to respond to calls like the one who, you know, involving a man named Takar Smith, whom we'll talk about in a little while with our next guest. But, you know, Takar Smith had been identified as having schizophrenia, being off his medication. But it was also made clear that there was a big knife in the apartment and that he had said he would rather fight than leave. Now, given that information, do you think it was the right call to not bring in an unarmed mental health response team?
Something that's really important to consider right off the bat is that the SMART team is still a part of LAPD. It's still a police officer, and it's sending out some kind of licensed therapist or psychologist with the police officer. And their primary role is to do assessments around whether or not somebody can be put on an involuntary hold. I watched the entire Takar Smith video, and we could get into some very minutiae on the detail of what decisions were made during that regarding scene safety and some other things. But I think the big point is that no matter who was sent there, the police alone or the SMART team with the police and a psychologist, their role was to essentially force him out of the house. And a psychologist would have done a 5150 assessment, which is to say they're assessing on whether or not he can have his civil rights removed for mental health reasons because he is either a danger to himself or to others. And that's their primary responsibility. The teams that I work on, the teams that I help set up, we are not focused or centered on doing 5150 assessments. Rather, we're centered on de-escalating somebody, helping them calm down, helping them come out of those escalated states due to either trauma or some kind of mental health issue, and help them think about things in a more clear and level-headed way. I have been in situations very similar to the Takar Smith situation, although I can't ever say it's exactly the same. And the goal is to talk to that person, help them de-escalate, and then clearly understand, hey, there's a restraining order against you. This is not a place where you can stay. This is a stressful situation, and help them find the resources that they need in order to find another place to sleep, another place to be at. Let's just, for example, explore what happens if the SMART team had been sent to that call. If they had deemed him eligible to be put on a hold for 5150, the next step would then be, again, to remove him physically from that scene. If they determined he needed to go with an ambulance, now we've got ambulance workers who are out there trying to remove him, which probably would not have gone well. So the police would have been involved again. And if they determined that he's not eligible to be put on a 5150 hold, now he still has a restraining order against him. He still is going to be removed physically. In neither of those scenarios, is there a concerted effort to mediate the conflict that's going on between him and his estranged wife, and work toward a more peaceable solution to the situation? And I think that's really where we need to focus our efforts on creating new systems that are unarmed, that are focused on that peaceable solution and not on the restrictive resolution.
I think a lot of folks, Paula, are frustrated by this continuing disparity of deaths in these calls, which lean heavily, obviously heavily, toward people of color. How do you speak to that? We talk about this over and over and over again, and it doesn't feel like it's getting better.
It does not. But speaking as an advocate, because a person has a problem, because the person potentially may need to have their civil rights removed at that moment, that is not a cause for death. When you talk to LAPD, when they review their own statistics about the number of citizens that they've killed in the past few years, a significant number have been individuals who've been in a crisis. But having a bad day, suffering anxiety, is not a reason to be killed.
Is this an issue, Paula, of insufficient training, do you think? Is this an issue of insufficient training for officers who handle these situations? Or do the procedure, obviously you're advocating for procedures to be changed. But how do you change them? How do you get those officers more training?
Yeah. So it's a combination of a number of factors: lack of accountability, no emphasis on de-escalation, possibly not following their own training rules, and most of all, having the wrong people present in many of those situations. You know, we have the statements from our chief of police, we have statements from others. It is always the one who has been harmed, it is always their fault. We did the best we can. The best we can do is to kill them.
Adam, if Paula says the wrong people showed up, who are the right people? How do you get the right people to these calls?
Yeah, I think that you made a good question as well around, is it just training or is it the system? And picking the right people means having the right system. I was talking to a friend about this situation the other day, and they said to me, if you take away somebody's flight, you're going to get their fight, referring to the fight or flight response. And I think that having a system that's designed to support people that doesn't remove their ability to have their flight so that we don't get their fight is really critical.
Ben Adam Clymer, who consults and trains local governments in the area of crisis intervention and trauma-informed care. Paula Miner, member of Black Lives Matter Los Angeles and the team leader for police accountability. Thanks to you both for coming on and talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on and raising this important topic.
Well, we've been looking at mental health, specifically instances where local law enforcement respond to calls of people having some sort of psychological crisis. And as we've been talking about, the LAPD has these so-called SMART teams, mental health assessment teams, to respond to these types of calls. but none were dispatched in any of the three recent cases, as I mentioned, in which people were killed by LAPD officers. In one of the cases, this is another one, not Keenan Anderson, this is the LAPD shooting and killing 46-year-old Takar Smith in the kitchen of his estranged wife. She had requested police help, noting that her estranged husband had suffered from mental illness and hadn't taken his medication. The county's Department of Mental Health has response teams as well, and a few years ago, even the city of L.A. approved a plan to develop a system of unarmed responders to those having some sort of mental health crisis. But that effort is still not off the ground. Dr. Jonathan Charon is the former director of the L.A. County Department of Mental Health. He resigned as of July of last year, but he's with us right now to talk about it. Doctor, thank you for coming on.
Oh, you bet. It's my pleasure.
The LAPD has response teams for sure. None of them use, though, in the three cases so far this year. The County Department of Mental Health does as well. The city is looking into them as well. I mean, this sounds like a lot of cooks potentially, but nothing got used. How does that happen?
Well, I mean, having enough capacity to respond in real time and to have responses coordinated is no easy feat, especially in a jurisdiction this large. You know, there are teams like you're describing called SMART. There's also one for the schools called START, and they are designed to be responsive in the field and to always lead forward with a care first type approach, recognizing that sometimes the circumstances, the scenarios change, and they can change in a heartbeat. So it's important that we always lean in with a care first approach, but that we recognize the need for law enforcement support.
Let's talk a little bit about Takar Smith, though, because we're talking about his estranged wife who had called authorities, police, to come help, but also said in the call, you know, she had requested help, but noted that her husband had suffered from mental illness, hadn't taken his medication. I believe it was for schizophrenia. If that information is out there with the police, then how does this SMART team not get included? I don't understand where the disconnect happens there. If it's noted in the call that this man has some sort of mental health crisis,
there's not always enough capacity with these teams to go into neighborhoods, to go into homes, to address situations as they evolve. You know, we have been invested as a society in what many would call the police beat, so that police can respond in within minutes in many scenarios. And we need to get the capacity for mental health services and the coordination with law enforcement to the point where we are providing a mental health beat, where there's not going to be a situation where we don't have capacity, where it's not coordinated. And I will say that, you know, the Board of Supervisors, and in particular Janice Hahn and Catherine Barger, were very proactive in this effort, and it's just going to take a while. It's not just you create a 988 number and everything falls into place. You have to have the back end. You need to have air traffic control with a regional call center. You have to have enough staff to go out and meet the demand. And you need to have receiving and stabilizing facilities so that when someone is engaged, rather than going to the jail or being left in the street, that we can get them into treatment.
How much of the outcome of a call response depends on actual timing? Like, as in, if the officers arrive first, but there is no mental health clinician with them, is it likelier that the result will be more violent?
It's not easy to tell from a phone call exactly what's going on. So if law enforcement shows up and looks and can secure the safety of the site and wait because a mental health professional and or a peer is en route, that's great. The problem there is, as you know, there are crises all over the place in a massive jurisdiction that draws upon law enforcement, draws upon mental health services, and this type of response system all day long, 24/7.
It might be difficult to describe exactly, but how does a mental health clinician actually respond differently from a police officer? Like you say, if there's a firearm or there's a weapon involved, the police have to secure the scene, right? And oftentimes that's when it gets violent. But what would a mental health assessor, a clinician, do differently from a police officer?
Well, I would say that a mental health professional who's trained and or someone with lived experience are more likely to engage an individual in a less threatening manner, from the clothes that they're wearing, from the language that they use that are based on kind of the training and or certification on the part of a peer. So it's not really always just a matter of training. It's a matter of, you know, what's your purpose as a professional in the community? Sitting with somebody who is upset, not looking down on somebody who is particularly upset, using language that doesn't feel threatening and that validates the feelings that they have. These are kind of basic tools that are needed in order to move a situation from escalating to de-escalating. And these are horrible outcomes. We've seen them for a long period of time. Of course, we would all love to mitigate them all. I can tell you that on a regular basis, these co-response teams are having an impact, and that there are people who are safe or safer because of them. It's just a matter of us over the next years getting the capacity, getting the coordination, and also informing the community about the existence of these types of services and the use of 988, which is a number that's designed to, in these types of situations, replace 911 and to increase the likelihood that a mental health response will be delivered and not one primarily through law enforcement.
Dr. Jonathan Sharon, former director of the Los Angeles County Department of Mental Health, thank you so much, sir, for coming on and being a part of this conversation.
You bet. I applaud you for doing it. It's this kind of awareness that will really make the difference. Thank you.
It's an important conversation for sure. The third police killing is the death of Oscar Sanchez. Reports were of a man with a knife in South L.A. throwing things at cars. When police arrived, Sanchez reportedly fled into a residence. Officers followed. You hear a voice on body cam video telling him to put that down. Police fired several shots. They handcuffed him, apparently tried to render aid. He later died. The LAPD is investigating, and other investigations may follow. We'll be back right after this quick break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA from KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. So, when you think of endangered species, I bet animals come to mind, like whales and pandas. But what about a shrub or trees or flowers? Like animals, the world's plant life is also under assault, with many species of flora on the razor's edge of extinction because of climate change and habitat loss. Well, here in Southern California, there's a place that's been working for decades to protect native plant biodiversity. Efforts that partly involve putting seeds into the deep freeze. Saul Gonzalez is the Los Angeles co-host of KQED's The California Report, and he got an invitation to visit, and he brings us this story.
Well, I'm going to take you to see some of our rarest plants.
I'm getting a tour of the plant nursery at the California Botanic Garden in the city of Claremont. Founded in 1927, it's the largest garden in the country, dedicated to protecting and showcasing California's native plants.
Let's see. Let's go this way.
My guide is Naomi Fraga, the garden's director of conservation programs. And one of our first stops is at a tray of finger-sized saplings.
Well, yeah, these are oak trees here.
These are oak trees?
Yeah, these are all oak babies, oak saplings, and different species.
And they're only like about 2 inches tall right now.
Well, yeah, they're going to turn into really big trees. Yeah.
How long does that take?
Oh, gosh. Centuries or decades at least to get established.
Beyond these oaks, Fraga tells me that when it comes to native plant diversity, no other state can compare to California.
And so there's over 6,500 kinds of plants that are native to California. Actually, we have more kinds of plants than any other state in the United States. We're incredibly rich and diverse.
but about a third of California's native plant species and population, says Fraga, are now endangered or threatened from overdevelopment, droughts, competition from invasive species, and wildfires. One local example, says Fraga, is the California black walnut.
So this is a plant that used to be abundant in Los Angeles County, all across the hillsides. And through development, populations have been declining, but there's a great interest to restore these populations. And so we are growing them actively here for restoration.
But if not carefully monitored and protected, many native plants might vanish for good.
So in order to save them, in order to conserve them, we need a directed effort to ensure that populations don't go extinct.
To do that, staff and volunteers from this botanic garden regularly travel into California's forests, fields, deserts, and coastal areas to search for the most threatened plants. When they find them, they take plant samples back to the garden where they can be grown in the nursery.
Many of them are very rare. They're in very precarious situations, and they could blink out at any moment. It's really very serious for certain rare plant populations. In fact, we have populations that we know are now extinct in the wild that our only place they exist is here in the botanic garden.
Really?
Yeah.
And in case a plant does vanish in the wild, this botanic garden has an additional fallback.
So we're coming here into the California Seed Bank, the largest seed bank dedicated to California native plants.
The heart of the seed bank is a laboratory space full of big freezer units bought at Home Depot. The same freezers people may have in their homes to store bulk quantities of food. But instead of steaks and pork chops, these freezers are filled with meticulously cataloged and packaged seed samples from a huge number of plants.
Could you open one?
Absolutely. This is one of the freezers that contains our rare plants. And the rare plants are in these heat-sealed foil packets, and they have the species identification on the label and how many seeds and the seed weight. All that information's in a database.
And it looks like, it looks like vacuum-packed camping food.
That's exactly what it looks like.
You can think of these freezers as biodiversity lifeboats. If one of the species in a freezer here went extinct, the seeds could be a way, maybe the only way, to bring the plant back.
So if something were to happen to that population, we're the best chance to have that population be restored and for that species to not be lost forever.
You're the backstop.
Yeah, absolutely.
The freezer stores seeds from about a third of the state's native plant life. But eventually, botanists at the garden want seed samples from all of them. Extra insurance against a possible future plant apocalypse. And Naomi Fraga says if you want to join the fight to protect California plant biodiversity, you can, namely by planting native flora like sage, milkweed, or California lilacs in your home garden or as part of community planting events.
I dream about that. I dream about native plant landscapes across people's yards, even if you can only do container plants on your balcony. It's really magical to build a garden and to see life just sort of arrive, and no contribution is too small.
If you want to visit the California Botanic Garden in Claremont, it's open from Tuesdays through Sundays. You can also purchase native plants at its nursery. There's a lot more information on the garden's website, calbg.org. For KCRW, I'm Saul Gonzalez.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, Mayor Karen Bass's new homeless response program looks, at least on the surface, like a slow-motion cleanup. Dare I say sweep, with a lot of promises that people don't necessarily believe. We'll have that tomorrow on the Inside Safe program right here on Greater LA. What's on your mind? Have a story idea for us? Let us know at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Subscribe to the podcast, too, while you're there. You don't have to wait until 2:30 or 6 to hear Greater LA. You can hear it on your time by subscribing to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts or at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Juliana Mayo, Nihar Patel, Zeke Reed, Sonia Geis, John Meek, Bill Richards, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all helped put the episode together this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for the time and, of course, the ear. Have a great night.